This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Repeat after me, everybody. It's yuan, not yuan or yen. We speak here, of course, of the suddenly less valuable Chinese currency, Beijing's latest try at a what? Me worry? Economic strategy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, the 12th of August. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. They tell you in radio training, early on, actually, in radio training, that it's never a good idea to use a lot of numbers in your stories. It's tough for people to keep up, they say. But the news is what the news is, so I'm just going to speak real slow-like for a minute here and tell you that the going rate for one American dollar today was 6.3868 Chinese yuan. Take my word for it that that puts the devaluation of the renminbi, as it's known, at 3.5% over just the past 2 days. You roll that in with some not great economic data out from Beijing today, and the idea that we started with yesterday on this program, that this is a global economy we're playing in, y'all, and you might thus fairly wonder, what does this all mean for us? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore starts us off.
The natural worry about a devaluation, especially out of China, is that it's going to directly hurt American exporters. Well, that ship has sailed. That ship has crashed and sunk, and we are no longer on that ship.
We compete much more with Europe and Japan than we do directly with China.
David Dollar is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
And our currency has appreciated something like 20 or 30% against the yen or the euro. So then this little bit of Chinese devaluation, you know, that's pretty small on top of that.
But what if the devaluation signifies a sharper slowdown in China than expected? Maybe Chinese leaders know something we don't.
What has markets a little more concerned here is that they feel if China is doing this, then things must be really bad in China.
Scott Sumner directs the program on monetary policy at the Mercatus Center.
China is a major commodity importer, so it affects countries like Brazil and Australia that sell commodities. It also affects countries like Germany that sell things like automobiles to China.
All of those countries buy things from us. If they're dragged down with China, we could feel it in our exports. On the other hand, for U.S. consumers and businesses who buy from China, devaluation's great. Prices will go down. On the third hand, the Federal Reserve wants to see prices rise so it can raise interest rates. Steve Kaplan teaches at GW University.
If there are more pressures coming from China and more deflation coming, that could perhaps postpone this interest rate hike that people have been expecting toward the end of this year.
So take your pick of economic ripples coming out of China. Which of them will actually make a splash? We don't know yet. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Crude oil gained just a hair today, still down under $44 a barrel, though, which will not be good news for advocates of renewable energy sources. Cheap oil can, as we know, dampen enthusiasm for low-carbon power. It's been a week or so since President Obama announced his clean power plan, calling for big changes to how power plants in this country work. We've called a guy who runs a company that operates a whole lot of plants. Ralph Izzo is the CEO of PSEG. They serve about three quarters of the power consumers in the great state of New Jersey. Mr. Izzo, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. It's good to be with you.
How big a deal for you is the clean power plan from the White House?
Well, it's a big deal for our company, and I think it's a big deal for our nation and our planet.
Is it a business problem for you, though?
No, I think that it's a business opportunity for us. I think it gives us a great opportunity to advocate some things that need to be done. Our primary initiative is in the area of energy efficiency, mm-hmm. Which is really basically infrastructure investments, only instead of being big wires, it's light bulbs and thermostats that can help people get the same type of service they want at a lower consumption. And we could be in a different type of business than we're in today.
Well, how does that match up, though, with the way we've done power in this country for 100 years, right, which is more power, more wires, more poles, more voltage, more everything, and now we're being told we got to use less?
Yeah, so my goal is to help people use a lot less and have it be far more reliable and have my shareholders make more money. And there's a simple way to do that. About 30 to 40% of a customer's bill is fuel. I'm not in the fuel business. So if I can get customers to use less fuel, I can lower their bills and lower my cost. If I lower my costs more than I lower their bills, then I make more money.
When you and your peers in the power business get together at conferences or wherever you guys see each other, how often does climate change come up in the conversation?
You know, every time. We realize that over the long term, it's an issue that needs to be addressed. There's not universal agreement on the exact mechanisms for addressing it, but I don't think there's a utility executive who doesn't recognize the science.
I wonder to what extent the White House and regulators, broadly speaking, are playing catch-up to an industry which, as you say, has been thinking about efficiency and climate change for a while now.
Well, it's funny. These races are never somebody jumps out in front and stays there. I would not say they're playing catch-up at all. It's really not that long ago. I mean, it's maybe 15 years or so that we began to realize that carbon dioxide was an issue. But I don't think it's been part of the public dialogue, nor was it part of the industry dialogue until really this administration.
So in 10 or 15 years, plus or minus, whenever these rules are set to go into effect, what does PSEG look like?
Oh, I think PSEG looks like a utility that has a much more reliable system that's independent of climate change. It's just the fact that you and I are becoming more and more electrified with each passing day, from toothbrushes to opening garage doors to smartphones. So a much more reliable system where fewer electrons are going through it, and the fewer electrons that are going through it because of energy efficiency are powered increasingly by carbon-free sources of energy, which range from nuclear to solar to wind.
And you will make more money by selling less of your product.
That's exactly right, with the right type of regulation. And customers will pay less. I know that seems strange, but fuel is such an important part of that bill. And if we reduce what we spend on fuel by more than what we reduce the customer's bill, we come out ahead.
Ralph Izzo, he's the chairman and CEO of PSEG. Mr. Izzo, thanks very much for your time, sir.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
Traders scratched and clawed their way to the closing bell today, got back to basically even they did. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The old trope about real estate is, of course, say it along with me if you know it, location, 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 about which, sure, fine, whatever. You know what matters more, though? Money matters more. And if you think real estate here is getting expensive, over in London, starter homes now cost more than 10 times average earnings. Fair housing advocates are appalled. One particular gripe being that some of the overseas buyers spending the most on real estate have come by their money in, shall we say, questionable ways. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Number 221B Baker Street is the handsome Georgian townhouse where fictional detective Sherlock Holmes once lived. Today, it could be a real-life crime scene. The property surrounding this famous address has been the subject of some recent serious sleuthing.
Hundreds and hundreds of hours of research involving looking at documents in Russian and German and, you know, company registers from around the world.
Chido Dunn and her colleagues at the anti-corruption group Global Witness have been on the trail of a master thief.
We conducted an investigation that revealed that big chunks of Baker Street, basically all the property surrounding the Sherlock Holmes Museum, is owned by someone with close links to Rakhat Aliyev.
He's been called the Moriarty of money laundering, Rakhat Aliyev, the late head of the secret police in Kazakhstan. He's reputed to have looted billions from the Kazakh treasury. It's not surprising that he or his associates would stash their cash here in London.
London has been a money laundering centre of choice for many, many years.
John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network, he says that the UK turns a blind eye to dodgy foreign cash laundered through British overseas territories like the Caymans, Bermuda and the British Virgin Islands. In recent years, he says, the dodgy cash has even fuelled the London real estate boom.
Very large inflows of dirty money mingled with large inflows of clean money have inflated London property markets to the point where the London property market is quite simply unaffordable to the vast majority of ordinary Londoners.
Another luxury apartment block goes up. Over the past decade, the London skyline has sprouted dozens of them. Most are sold to foreign investors. But who, precisely? Almost $200 billion worth of British real estate, much of it in London, is now owned anonymously by foreigners registered abroad. Local activist Andrew Barshall claims it's turning parts of London into a ghost town.
We've seen these huge new blocks go up, which are 75% empty. They're all sold, the flats, but nobody lives in them.
These are all foreign investors, then?
These are foreign investors, these are money launderers, these are South American drug dealers hiding their money in London.
Barshall believes that one of the worst effects of this foreign-fuelled property boom will be felt here, in a century-old low-income housing project right in the middle of one of the most expensive parts of London.
This is the Sutton Estate in Chelsea, in the centre of London. It's a stunning estate and it's beautifully built. This
was the cluster of fine old red brick apartment blocks was built from the legacy of an Edwardian philanthropist. He left his money to provide low-cost housing in a good neighbourhood for London's working poor. The plan today, to demolish and rebuild most of the estate. In the process, some of the residents will be sent to live outside London. 40% of the accommodation will be turned into luxury apartments, some costing up to $6 million.
What we're seeing here is nothing less than the social cleansing of the working poor from the centre of the city.
The Sutton Estate Housing Association and the local council both insist they need the extra funds from the redevelopment to build and maintain more properties. But Ian Henderson, a Sutton tenant, accuses them of cashing in on a dodgy boom.
They value property and profit more than people. They look at the land values, they see how much money they can make, and they just want to move the poor people out of London and just hand it over to the rich.
Central government, at least, does seem to be worried about the impact of illicit money on London housing. The Prime Minister is mulling over a new measure that will make it mandatory for anyone buying real estate in Britain to be identified. That won't stop this city's property boom, but it may help cool it. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If you were to draw a Venn diagram of magazines, high fashion, and ad dollars, that tiny little spot where those three circles intersect would be labeled the September issue of Vogue magazine. Probably, actually, it would be labeled the much-awaited September issue of Vogue magazine, because it always is. It's chock full of ads, glamorous photo spreads as well. But this year, it's also the venue for an unlikely partnership. The magazine is going to feature ads from Target. Target's trying to distance itself from the discount retailer label, and Vogue is following the money that comes with tapping into new demographics. So how's that going to work out? Marketplace's Gigi Dubin did some asking around.
When was the last time you picked up a copy of Vogue? Simon Unglis is executive director of the Fashion School at Academy of Art University.
Really, it's the biggest percentage of the people that look at that. I think everyday regular people going to the doctors, and there's a copy of it sat in the doctor's waiting room.
Vogue does publish more than a million copies, but magazines in general have been hurting. So Unglis says it makes sense that a consumer-driven publication with hundreds of pages of ads to fill would look to Target. Elizabeth Wissinger teaches fashion studies at the City University of New York Graduate Center. She says the Target-Vogue deal, not that weird.
The dividing lines between how we're going to get high-end luxury goods versus mass-produced items is blurred.
Technology makes the connection between Vogue and Target very direct. Readers can scan a code on the ad page and go right to a Buy Now button. Ari Lightman teaches digital media and marketing at Carnegie Mellon University. He says that's gold.
Target's a very voracious consumer of data.
Also, Target wants to reach into Vogue readers' deeper pockets, he says. And Vogue gets to say to advertisers, hey, look, people aren't just seeing your ads, they're buying stuff. To understand how big that is, Lightman says, look no farther than his 14-year-old daughter. She bought a fashion magazine during a recent vacation.
She's reading the magazine with her phone in her hand.
Now, consumers who are all about instant gratification can go from seeing something to owning it a lot faster. I'm Gigi Dubin for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This really is a great signification of hope and transformation and growth for the city.
Straight out of Compton, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off a fraction of a point today. We'll call that flat, 17,402. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, about a tenth percent, 5,044. The S&P 500 also flat-ish, 2,086 at the bell. All right, so let's start with Alibaba, the giant Chinese e-commerce company. Shares tanked 5.1% today after the firm said growth slowed to its lowest rate in more than 3 years. Moving on now to Yahoo, which has a 15% stake in Alibaba. It thus felt the pinch as well. Yahoo shares off 4.25%. How's this for a business plan? Find rich customers who like to make repeat purchases. That's a strategy for Wayfair Incorporated, the online home furnishing retailer. Saw shares up 28% today on a big jump in customer base, even bigger jump in revenue last quarter. Bonds were steady on a steady kind of day. The yield on the 10-year T-note, steady, 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues retail sales data for July. The Perseid meteor shower is at its peak. Early morning looks promising. Make a wish. Or maybe many. And happy Left-Handers Day to some of you. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Texas-based ice cream maker Bluebell has announced that it's on its way back to the market 4 months after a listeria outbreak, which sickened people in 4 states and killed 3 in Kansas. That raises something of a tricky corporate question. How do you announce your return without reminding people why you left? Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein is on it.
Crisis management comes down to 3 things, says NYU marketing professor Scott Galloway, and only 3 things.
But they're really hard to do and easy to rationalize ignoring.
The first, says Galloway, is to acknowledge the problem. The second is to get the CEO to be the face of the crisis. Finally, overcorrect. Think Tylenol in the early 80s when Johnson & Johnson recalled 31 million bottles of their pain reliever. Once you've done all that...
America and consumers love to forgive. It's like a relationship. When your spouse gets angry at you, the easiest way to end the issue, you're right, I'm sorry, this is what I'm going to do to address the issue. It's the same thing in the world of business.
Bluebell's social media strategy appears to be following Galloway's advice step by step. Here's Paul Cruzy, the company's CEO, on its Vimeo channel.
Our entire history has been dedicated to making the very best and highest quality ice cream we possibly could. And we're committed to fixing the problem.
When a company looks to come out of something like this, short-term pain is expected. Bluebell has laid off more than a third of its workers and taken out a $125 million line of credit. Brandon Cashin is with the firm Addison Whitney. He says to survive, Bluebell needs to turn the page.
You get to a point where the more you try and say I'm sorry, the less effect it has.
Cashin knows other companies have been down similar roads and that their experience shows Bluebell could end up stronger than before. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Come Friday, a small city here in Southern California, just south of downtown L.A., is going to get a whole lot of publicity. Compton is the setting for the new film Straight Outta Compton. It's a biopic of sorts, I guess, about the rise of the iconic West Coast gangster rap group N.W.A. It's a journey back in time, the film is, to when that city was plagued by gangs and violence and poverty. 27 years after N.W.A.'s first album, though, also called Straight Outta Compton, the city has changed. David Weinberg has been spending some time there.
When Jatierra Fuller walked into the classroom on her first day of fourth grade, she was surprised. She was the only black person in her class.
There was no diversity. There were no Indians, no Asians, no Filipino, nobody. It's just Latinas and me. That's it.
Jatierra's mom, who grew up in Compton, was sure that the school had made a mistake.
My mom thought they put me in like a bilingual or like English learners class or something and all this. And they're like, no, she's in the gifted class. That's where she's supposed to be. So
what was that like?
Most of my friends were Latina and they couldn't relate to like my hair problems or like my butt problems or something. I don't know. It was just like a foreign world to them.
This is one of the biggest differences between the Compton of 1988 and the Compton of today. Latinos make up about two-thirds of the population. Jatierra is 24 now. She's a graduate of Cal State Long Beach. And last year, she became the Queen of Compton when she won the 2014 Miss Compton pageant.
Representing Compton is such an honor, but it's also very exciting when you get to go outside of Compton because a lot of people already have like a lot of negative stigmas on people from Compton. So it's very important to me to be able to showcase Compton in such a positive light.
When Jatierra travels outside the city, people are surprised that she's never seen a drive-by or a drug deal. They're also shocked to hear that Compton now has a Chipotle.
That was really exciting because I was thinking, like, Chipotle's down the street from my house. I can get some guacamole and some chips, and I'll be ready to go. And then Compton has a Target.
The Chipotle and the Target are both part of a shopping center called the Gateway Town Center. It looks like a shopping center you would find in any suburb in America. Lots of asphalt, a Home Depot, a 24-hour fitness. To a lot of communities, a shopping center like this is not a big deal. But in Compton, it means jobs and tax revenue for a city where more than a quarter of the residents live in poverty.
This is the first major development in the city of Compton in over 30 years.
This is Asia Brown, the mayor of Compton.
This really is a great signification of hope and transformation and growth for the city. So it's really one of the hearts of the city where you can run into neighbors, family members, and just really be able to get the basic things that a lot of times other communities take for granted.
Brown is 33. She's the youngest mayor in Compton's history. She was elected in 2013. Her background is in urban planning and development, but lately she's been fielding a lot of calls about gangster rap.
At the height of NWA's success, Compton had triple the homicides than we have today. Compton is much safer now than it was before.
The economy here is improving, but there's still a long way to go. The Compton School District gets a rating of 3 out of 10. The unemployment rate is about twice the national average, and the city has struggled to keep up its infrastructure.
And the potholes, it's like the moon crater going in the rover.
Carlos Acevedo is the owner of Frank's Carburetors. It's been in Compton for 52 years. The shop is littered with piles of old carburetors and dozens of glass jars filled with tiny metal parts. Carlos was born in California. He grew up speaking Spanish. And over the last couple decades, he's watched the Latino population rise in Compton. But the city's political leadership doesn't reflect that change. Only one of the city's four council members is Latino.
In the school board, there's no Hispanics representing all these Hispanic people there. Okay, so we have tried.
Carlos is president of the Latino Chamber of Commerce. And he's been trying to get more Latinos to the polls for local elections. He showed me a poster he made that sits behind the counter of his shop. It has a picture of Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King Jr. and a copy of the Voter Bill of Rights.
This poster really signifies representation and the opportunity for all of us. It's not to push nobody out, but it should be more share in the democracy, in the power.
On my way out, Carlos points to some black smudges on the concrete. It's melted tire. Someone parked a truck in front of his shop, and then the truck blew up.
Boom! Exploded and went into flames. So when I came the next morning, I said, what happened here?
Carlos believes it was intentional and that it had something to do with his political activism. But the fire department said it was a miscellaneous fire. This past Saturday, Jatiera Fuller's reign as the Queen of Compton came to an end when she crowned the new Queen of Compton. She's going to miss it, especially being in a position to empower youth, though she still gets to do that at her job.
I'm a children's social worker, so I work for the Department of Children and Family Services, which is pretty exciting because I get to service Compton.
And she won't be stepping completely out of the spotlight. In 2 weeks, she will go on to represent Compton in the Miss California pageant. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
We asked a bunch more Compton residents to reflect on how their city has changed and why so many of them refuse to leave. The video is online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, a few items from the Marketplace desk of Wait, Your Company is Worth How Much? Media edition. We learned today that NBC Universal, among the oldest of old line media companies, is taking a big stake in a couple of not old line media companies, $200 million in Vox Media, which values Vox at more than 1 billion American simoleons. Also, reports of another $200 million going into BuzzFeed, which puts them at $1.5 billion. I'm obliged to note here, just in full disclosure, that there are investment opportunities in a certain public radio program, if you know what I mean. Seriously, call us. Go ahead. All right, the Dow off a fraction of a point today, flat. The NASDAQ up 7 points at 10%. The S&P 500 also basically flat. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lant, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.